I would really like to thank Freeman and State Job and Canada College Conference Coordinator and Aaron Martinez for the wonderful meal tonight. It was awesome. Thank you. It is my pleasure to welcome Stephanie Graham, our VP academic at Canada College, who will introduce our keynote speaker.
Thank you, John. John Perron. Perron. People always have trouble with my name, but she did a great job. Well, I have the pleasure tonight of introducing our keynote speaker, Stephen Downs. And Stephen is a senior researcher with the National Research Council since 2001, and he's currently based in Moncton, New Brunswick, at the Institute for Information Technologies E-Learning Research Group. And Stephen has certainly become a leading voice in the areas of learning objects and metadata, as well as the emerging fields of web blogs and education and content syndication. On a more personal side, Stephen has shared with us photos he's taken as he's lived across Canada. So you might have noticed wild chickens from Stanley Park to the shores of a forest in New Brunswick to the streets of Toronto. So it's always wonderful when you can combine a passion you have in your work with a passion you have in your own life. And Stephen has certainly a love of nature and turns himself and sees himself certainly as an environmentalist, and it's certainly reflected in his art. So thank you for sharing that with us. And now I will give you the mic and give you the floor.
Well, hello, everyone. The first few words are for him to do the sound check. They're not really part of the talk. How are we doing there?
A bit close to that.
And I have to be careful not to stand in front of the light, not because it will block your view, but because I'll blind myself and I'll be walking around. It's a pleasure to be here, and I am, of course, more than a little humbled to be able to speak to all of you today and to have your attention, particularly those of you who are still eating. I'm beginning with a wonderful meal here, and I'm more than a little intimidated by it. But you should keep eating. I would. This is not my first time in North Bay. I've been here before. Someone said earlier, well, I hope we make this a very memorable experience for you. This is a memorable experience, for sure. This is absolutely the first time I have ever spoken in an airplane hangar. I was thinking, well, why would they invite me? Like that. And I was thinking, well, maybe it was something I wrote, maybe it's learning objects or blogs. As soon as I came into this room, I realized they want somebody with a loud voice. And that's me. So I hope you can hear me in the back. I'm getting all kinds of echoes here, so I'm recording this talk as well, so I'm kind of curious to see how that comes out and afraid at the same time. So this is memorable, but it will be hard for this trip to be as memorable as my first trip to North Bay. My first trip to North Bay was in the winter of 1983-1984, and I was a lot younger then, and I was a student at the University of Calgary, and I had just been elected the editor of the student newspaper, The Gauntlet. As such, I won the prize, which was to be part of The Gauntlet's delegation to the annual national conference of the Canadian University Press, which was being held here in North Bay. So I got on the bus, bused across the country, came to the conference, and we were all in the Pinewoods Hotel. We took over the whole hotel, hundreds of student journalists from across the country, like student journalists, of course, arguing about social change. We went in, we're from Alberta, so we're conservative, and we came in, and we're not agents of social change, we're agents of social awareness. And so this debate was raging back and forth. We had a conference newspaper, of course, a bunch of journalists, and producing conference newspaper, a conference newspaper set up the typesetting equipment, produce this thing every day, and all that. The conference is going great, starts the day after Christmas, goes through to January 3rd, and of course the highlight of the conference, the New Year's party. So, big New Year's bash, and we're producing a special New Year's edition of our conference newspaper, and we burned the hotel down. Yeah. Oh, there were police, there were fire engines, there was smoke, there was evacuations. We were all taken to the Ramada. The Pinewood, just can't believe the Pinewood stopped because, of course, they're now an employee. But they still took care of us. They actually came down to the hotel with us. That was a pretty memorable time. So that's what I think about when I think about North Bay. I realized I was coming back here, and I see now you put me in a cement building. You know, student newspaper days, I learned so much. I spent 5 years working at the student newspaper at the University of Calgary, the Gauntlet. It's a time I hold dear in my life. I would never give it up. I probably should have attended classes as well, but I learned a lot. I got to do things like meet with cabinet ministers and argue with them, and tour the country. I learned how to write quickly and sometimes well. I learned to be an observer of things. And everything that you think about, when you think about what's involved with journalism, running it, I gained. And I know a lot of you know me now through my daily newsletter, and so consequently, you probably think of me from the point of view of being a journalist of sorts, and I am a journalist of sorts. But I'm also a philosopher of sorts, and I'm also an instructional designer of sorts. Mm-hmm. And what's happened over the years is that I've carried with me not just what I learned working at the Gauntlet, but I've also carried with me a lot of the practices that made it possible to do something like that. I mean, student newspapers in this country, anyways, I know they're different in other countries, but in Canada, student newspapers, for the most part, are entirely student-run. And you don't go in there, there isn't a professor telling you how to do it or anything like that. You go in there, you work with the other people in the student newspaper, and you learn over a space of years to craft for yourself. And so, it's not just a hobby. It never was just a hobby, it was more of a lifestyle. It's a dedicated exercise in self-learning. And so I've taken a lot of that with me from my student newspaper days. And now, these many years later, working as a researcher, I carry those along with me, those habits and those ideas. And so I thought that for today's talk, what I would do is I would share what I've learned, anyways, about how to be a good learner. And hence the name of the talk. Now, the conference organizers were saying, wait a sec, he didn't say he was going to do that. It's okay, I'm still going to do what I promised. Yeah, I'm going to put it this way. Now, I'm going to test this. It's a mouse and it's a laser pointer, so you have to do that to me. It's unarmed. There we go. I don't know, I'm sure, as I checked earlier, you in the back cannot read this, but that's okay. It's not important. My talk today is broken down into three major parts. It will be more or less an hour, which means about 30 minutes apart. I wrote a thing a few weeks ago called Some Principles of Effective E-Learning. And these are the principles here. This is what I'll be talking about during this talk. The three principles are interaction, usability, and relevance. And I came to this conference fully intending to deliver a talk on effective principles of e-learning. But as I was here, I decided that, the conference is about learning, and it's about e-learning. I talked to a whole bunch of people here and got a whole bunch of stories, and I realized that these are also effective principles of effective learning generally. So if you want to be a good learner, these are the principles that you should be looking toward and adhering to. At least that's what I was thinking this afternoon. Moral might be a different story, but at the very least, it will give you a framework to think about and to structure some thoughts along these lines. So, looking at the first of these principles, the first of these principles is interaction. And you're all involved in distance learning. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything new. Interaction is important in order to learn. It's important for two reasons. First of all, in order to establish human contact. We know that we connect with learning better when we know that we're talking to a person at the other side. You've all had the experiences with those, I don't know what they're called, when you phone somebody and they say, please get one for this and two for that and so on. You go all the way through that, you go through the menu, you go through the menu, and it says, I'm sorry, they're not available. It's not funny. And it's just, you can handle the fact that the person wasn't available if a person answered the call and said, sorry, they're not here. But to be taken through this process by a machine sort of separates you from the reality of what's on the other side. So it's important to have that human contact, to know that there is a person on the other side of the line. The other side of interaction, this is a side that's a bit less talked about, although this morning's keynote was talked about, I thought that was great, is the process of interaction itself produces content. It produces content that is created by both yourself and by other people who are out there. Now, if you are a learner and you want to learn things, probably some of the best content that you get, learning content, will be produced not in a textbook, not a pre-fabricated online course or something like that, but in an email message or a discussion post that was created by another human being out there somewhere who was engaged in some sort of discussion. I'm always reminded of a study that Erin Brewer did. She studied learning on Yahoo groups. That's not an LMS or anything like that. But she discovered there's a lot of learning that happens in Yahoo groups. And what makes the learning happen is the interaction between people who want to know something and people who know these things. And one example she gave was beekeeping. And how do you raise bees? And the person says, well, I need to teach bees how to do such and such. And what happens at that point is a process of negotiation back and forth between the learner and the person who knows. In trying to find out, not just to deliver the information, but find out why they need to know and to deliver the appropriate information in the appropriate context. Well, so I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about being an effective learner, and so I'm trying to read it from there, and it's just not working. The learning in the traditional way is not particularly conducive to interaction. This is a good example, because we're sort of interacting because you're all looking at me, but there isn't really the dialogue, right? This is a very traditional kind of learning setting, right? That's why I'm all comfortable, because I come to a talk, I like to sit down, I like to have a chat with people and get the dialogue going. But In a very traditional setting, you get somebody standing up in front of the room, they'll broadcast, and you will be passive receivers. Even where there's interactivity, if you consider the typical learning management system, you have your learning content, you do your page turner, right? Keep your page turner. And then what happens is, if you want to have some interactivity, you're going to go to the discussion area. So what does that mean? Well, you have to click here, find the right topic, click here, scroll through the answer, remember to present, and then maybe you can type something in. It's a very strange sort of setup. It's as though we had this talk here, and then we decide, okay, we'll all get up, I'll go over into the next group, that'll be the discussion room, and that's where we'll talk. And then when we're done talking, we'll come back here for some more content. That's the way learning management systems are set up. So, if you are looking for interaction, because you want to be a good learner, you're not going to get the interaction from traditional learning opportunities. You are going to have to think of yourself as building an interaction network, placing yourself at the center of this network. And this is very much what I do, is I place myself at the center of the network, and then I create non-formal channels of interaction. So let's think about what the structure of your personal interaction network looks like. And some of these seem familiar to you. To me, they seem like dead familiar. I've been doing them so long, it's second nature to me. Things like email mailing lists. I've listed a few of the lists that I subscribe to, DDoS, www.edu, IT Forum, etc. These are incredible non-formal learning communities. I learned so much from them. I realize I'm standing at one spot, which means there's a fan of people over there who can't see. They're all gone. So I'll stand here now. How's that? Still can't see it. It's a completely different sound over here. It's just, well, these dynamics are just something else. Maybe you have to experience this because maybe not put so much feedback. I may have to go back over there. I actually, I won't say got my start, but certainly got a tremendous leg up in the field of instructional design through these mailing lists. And it's important to keep in mind, and I'll certainly say this here, that these lists are useful not just for people, not just in the sense that you can read them and learn a whole bunch of stuff, although that is the case, but also, too, they're a good place for you to contribute ideas of your own. Float trial balloons, test out arguments. I put out many, many bad arguments on DDoS and www.dev and other lists before I hit good arguments. I'm still not sure I'm hitting all good arguments. Right. But the important thing is to get them out there, to get that communication going back and forth. Today's version of participation in mailing lists, of course, is weblogging. And I'm sure you've all heard I don't want to say fad, but sort of close to the fad of weblogging. But again, and people depict weblogging as, you're just going to publish a whole bunch of stuff, about your private life, about your cat, and, well, I do that. But the thing with weblogs is, again, despite the depictions in the media, and there are many of these depictions, weblogs and weblogging, this is not a publishing medium. It's an interactive medium. The first thing you should be doing with weblogs is reading them. And what I would do, if I was in a program where I was trying to make myself a good learner, is I'd find a bunch of weblogs that related to my field and I'd start reading them. But of course, you don't just read them, you read them actively. When you start, I remember a long time ago taking a course, they talked about active listening. and yet you're an active listener, because you hear something, you kind of reflect it back. But you do the same sort of thing with buzzbugs. Excuse me. You read them, and then you reflect back. You either put something in the comments, sometimes even just to let the person writing know that you were there, because writing a weblog can be a very lonely business sometimes. A lot of weblogs have like one or two readers, and if you drop a single comment in the contents, the person will realize, oh, my readership is tripled. So they like that. But also, too, you get this dialogue going back and forth. And then if you have something longer to say, you put it in your own weblog, and you link back to them. And then the person can hear, not only do I have a comment, I've got a link to me. All right. But again, it's this connection, it's this interaction. Other forms of communication, instant messaging, for example, ICQ. Is something I use all the time. AOL Instant Messenger, Yahoo Messenger. How many of you use ICQ or any of these instant messaging programs on a regular basis? Yeah, way fewer than that. Skype is like instant messaging, except it's audio. It's like your telephone on your computer, except unlike your telephone, it's completely free. If you call to somebody's other real telephone, it costs money. But I mean, a Skype to Skype call is free. The software is free. How many of you use Skype? Almost the same hands as these instant messaging. I will tell you, for the most part, many of your students are using these now. So it's a great communications tool. I use it all the time. If I have a question, a problem, or something like that, to pop onto ICQ, ask the question, the person answers within a couple of seconds, I just keep going on. Great learning tool. It also saves me a lot of phone bills when I'm on the road, because I just ICQ instead of phone at home. Online forums, again, this is probably the part that you're most familiar with, because they're sort of almost the most traditional. But discussion forums, I mentioned CIDR, which is a series of online forums being hosted by Terry Anderson and the people at Athabasca University. A very good place to get interacting, communicating with people online. Still not used to this. Principles of interaction, I made them up. But they're still they're principles to me. Oh, Jesus. I don't know how you're doing that.
We can read it on your text. Yeah.
Well, that's good. It is all new to you. It really is something trying to settle into this room. Boy. A very kind audience, a really harsh room. That's okay though. Pull is better than push. What do I mean by that? Push is when somebody sends something to you. Pull is when you get something from someone else. Push is like email. Somebody writes up a message and sends it to you. Pull is like the web. You decide what page you're going to go to, you type in the address, you go get the page. Why, you may ask, is pull better than push? Because they both seem to work, right? Well, in a small network, they do both work. When you put 1 billion people online, you don't want them pushing at you. The natural result of push, and we see this over and over again, is things like spam, things like viruses, all these unwanted messages. Even if one person in 10,000 sends you something that you don't want, it still means you're going to be like 3 or 4 hours reading your messages. So when you're thinking about, okay, I want to get communications going with other people, the less you can depend on push, and the more you can depend on pull, the better. Today, you're probably hearing about something called RSS. How many of you have heard of RSS? About half. Okay, I'll come back to that in a little bit. But RSS is a pull type of media. What it is a way for you to choose the content that you want to bring it back to. I'll come back to that, so it's a promise. Of course, I've made promises before. Another principle, hard principle for a lot of people, speaking your own voice in an authentic voice, and listen to other voices for authenticity as well. What that means, that doesn't apply so much for this crowd, except for the trade show set. They're all lined up with that. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know where they are. Otherwise, I'd point them up because laser pointer. The trade show set should be listening to this. Market speak, not on. Because people are beginning to see through it. I think we've pretty well seen through it. Seen through it already. And that. Somebody was saying that I also needed somebody who enunciates really well. I think they got the wrong guy. Trying to be something other than yourself, particularly in an online communication, tends not to be effective. And the reason why, we could go all Lacanian in here and talk about it being a cool medium rather than a long medium. Television is a medium where you can sort of put on a front because television creates a very strong emotional connection with you. And so the appearance, the precise styling, the music in the background, all of that can create an emotional state in your mind, which means you can get away with just about anything, and advertisers do. The internet is a very, I don't want to say cold, because then everybody will think about warm, cold, all that, not many, but it's a very cold medium, or maybe a better way of putting it, a very analytical medium. You get a messaging, you have time to think about it. You're not going, 30-second commercial, show, 30-second commercials, but email. Okay, think about that. Now, everybody depicts digital communications fast, but really, it's very slow. I remember CFGO. I don't know if you remember, those of you who don't live in Ottawa would never remember CFGO. So I remember when CFGO came on the air. It was a radio station. The big thing about CFGO that was in the media at the time, no quiet time, ever. You know on a radio, especially CBC, right here, CBC, okay, and that was the weather. And now, in sports today, CFGO. And that was the letter. That was first today. Right. I was karaoke ahead of time. Right. Just pushing right at you. You can't get away with that online. You can't make a person read an email quickly. And you can't make a person read a blog post quickly. That means people have time to reflect and absorb and think about what you're saying, and it becomes easier to spot the pretense. And because it's easier to spot the pretense, it becomes more important to have an authentic voice when you're communicating online. That's my perception, anyways. Share. You'd think it would be obvious, but it's not obvious. It's not obvious because a lot of our communications and a lot of our content is commercialized today. People have. Ooh, if I keep this to myself, I can make money from it. And it doesn't work. I talked about mailing lists giving me a leg up in my career. My own personal thinking about myself is that my knowledge isn't any greater than any of yours. My experience certainly isn't any greater than any of yours. The thing that has me in a position to do a talk like this is that when I get information, I share it. Because it grows. You get a little bit of information, you share it, and somebody shares back because they're thankful. You get a little bit more information, you share it, now you share more information, people start sending you more. Eventually, people start sending you information because they know you're going to share it, and they want you to share it. And so, you end up in a position where you're getting information in all the time because you're not trying to keep it. You're acting like a reflector. If the objective, and again, this is the objective, is to create communications, because that's the way to learn, then the way to learn is to share what you've already learned. I guess these principles don't flow that well, do they? They just didn't jump around. I'm very self-reflective when I do stuff like this, and sometimes I'm self-reflective aloud, which I probably shouldn't be, but I put the last one in there because people look at my newsletter, even at this conference, people look at my newsletter, oh, I'm sorry, they're meeting back and forth again. And they say, well, how can you do it? How can you do the newsletter every day like that? And I say, well, it's only weekdays, but that doesn't really answer the question. And the way it can be done, and the way it needs to be done, if you want to be learning by being a communicator, is to make it a priority, make it a habit. I tell people, and it's quite accurate, my newsletter is something that's just part of my life. It's just there. It's just, you know, you have breakfast, you do a newsletter. You know, you walk to work, you do a newsletter. You know, if you had a dog, walking the dog wouldn't be something that, you know, gee, I don't have any time for that. You make time because, well, your dog might die. Okay, sometimes these analogies don't go where you want them to. But the point here is that, you know, people say, I don't have time to read email, I don't have time to write email, and you do have time. Everybody has time. Everybody has, in fact, and I can prove this empirically, exactly the same amount of time that I do. It's just they choose to spend their time in other ways. And so you do have time. It becomes a question of organizing your time, deciding what things are important and you're going to do, or what things are not important and you're not going to do. Writing reports, not important. Blogging the same information, very important. You can tell just how much my sister loves me.
Can I have that in writing?
Yeah. Can I have that in writing, he says. Okay, here's the slide that's going to get me flagged by Homeland Security. Guerrilla tactics. And I've got guerrilla tactics for the other things too. You are not working in institutions that are set up to help you learn. Right? You're all supposed to go, right? This slide, in fact, the first point comes from this morning. It really was a good keynote talk. I enjoyed it a great deal. But again, it wasn't interactive, right? They did the same thing to him that they did to me here. They got him up in front of a room full of people and said, okay, go to a Cornell. If interaction isn't provided, create it. Now, I don't mean jump up and interrupt the speaker, although I don't mind if you do, that's fine. I noticed, as I was sitting in that room, my eyes went back to this, maybe I missed some people in the back or something. I'm the only one in that room with a computer up, open, taking notes. Maybe there were some other people I just didn't see, right? Maybe some people were doing it with, like, archaic analog technology. I'll take that as an editorial comment. Although I will point out, it was an archaic analog editorial comment. You're giving somebody's giving you some really great content where you've got a talk like this, and what you should be doing is interacting with it. And if you can't interact with the person who's speaking, at least create some kind of interactive activity happening in your head. Work with the material. Take the material in. Reformulate it as it's going by. You know? I mean, interaction doesn't have to always be outspoken and all of that. I had great conversations with myself. I had a full hour-long running argument with the speaker because he's speaking, I'm writing it down, and I'm writing it down. I think, is this true? No. But think about that. He keeps recommending Microsoft. And the thing is, if you're not weighing that stuff as it comes in, it might just go in and sit there and sit in the back of your mind and it just got in there. You have no idea how it got there, but all of a sudden you say, yes, I will get Windows. You don't know. So you have to interact. If your software, and you really mean software there, but if your software doesn't support interaction, add it. Now, by software, what I meant there, most specifically when I wrote it, was your learning management system. And you have a learning management system. Many of you have these content pages, and these content pages are static, barren, deserts of text and images, and there's nothing happening there. But with a little flip of JavaScript, you can put a little comment, comment engine right in the middle of it. With a little RSS to JavaScript thing that Alan will do and produce. You can put a dynamic content feed into the static content. I say go gorilla with your LMS. If your LMS is dysfunctional, do whatever it takes to get interaction into those pages. Talk to some of the students that you may have in computer science or whatever and stuff. But just whip up a little JavaScript interaction point and put it in these pages. I know they'll know how to do it because it's not hard. It's amazing that they haven't done it, that the LMS design companies haven't done it, but it is possible. Your web pages, your college web pages, make sure there's feedback mechanisms. At the very least, make sure you contact whatever. It's amazing how many websites I go to, there's no contact information whatsoever. You have to search for it in Google to find out who to talk to at such and such a website. Use back channels. Again, here I am talking to you guys. What you should be doing is using instant messaging or IRC or a chat room or something like that to be sending comments back and forth and among yourself. There have been some conferences, not this one, not very many actually, surprisingly few, where you have the static, boring slides. I told you guys in the back that these aren't working a whole lot. There's nothing happening there, right? But you got another big screen, and that's where the chat channel is. Everybody in the room, well not everybody, but a bunch of people in the room have their wireless computers or their little handheld computers with their wireless access, and they're typing in comments, and the comments are showing up there. Interestingly, behind the speaker, where he can't see them. But if they don't provide this for you, do it anyways. You know, I guess, well, you guys can use these cell phones, so. But you know, cell phones have SMS, you can do SMS. You guys should be putting messages back and forth. About the talk, about the hockey game, about American Idol, whatever. This is a bit of an aside, something of an aside. A lot of teachers say, I don't want all of this happening in my class. I don't want people doing instant messaging. I don't want people doing chats and IRC. My thinking on this is the following. If you can't compete with something this big that has text this high, you really do need to rethink what it is you're doing at the front of the classroom. I love them. Well, I'm the type of person, you know, those sliding doors that have the Star Trek doors, you know. I'm the type of person I go, because I just like to think, yeah, I'm making it open. And ironically, I am, because that use case, they used to use pads, but these days they use little sensors, so when you do that, it actually does set it off. So it really is magic. How am I doing on time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, 3 hours. Usability. Questions here, 40 minutes for the introduction, 10 minutes for the first bit of content, intermission, 29? No, I'm just kidding. I'm still getting used to this work. Usability, everybody thinks usability, they think Jacob Nielsen, they think usability task, little focus group, you get 5 people in there, they're okay, find the course, or you know, find the text, or whatever. Anyhow, usability, I guess that's sort of usability, but usability to me boils down to two things. Consistency, simplicity. I was quite a piece. I can do that again. I don't know if I can do that again. Simplicity. Well, not there. It'll come back when I least expect it. Kind of like black flies. No. You can't really have consistency without simplicity. You can't really have simplicity without consistency. So they are really sort of two sides of the same coin. When I look for the most usable websites on the web, I look to the websites that are designed, and I mean this quite seriously, by the masters, Google and Yahoo. And it's interesting because they're two very different sites. And you know, you sort of always think of them in the same breath, but they're not. Yahoo started off as a directory, a portal, when portals weren't cool, right? And, you know, you category, you drill down for your category, and I remember Yahoo had some rough times because, you know, their category was like 40 entries long. And click. And you go, go through the list, we don't have time. Google, on the other hand, was intended to provide access to a search engine. They had very powerful search technology, and they needed to give people quick and easy access to it. These very different orientations, and yet they pretty much hit on the same formula. Very simple design. Even if you go to Yahoo today, it looks pretty complicated, but if you think about how much information is on that home page, and you look at the design of the individual sections, it really is very simple design. Almost nothing in the way of images. Drop-down lists or selections, things like that, we got little neat little HTML images, not to be found. Icons, pretty well, almost no icons. And if there is an icon, its meaning is very obvious in the context. Google, even more simple, right? Little boxes. There's search. And you're done. Compare that. Just get some water here. And also, I want to hear a different sound in my ear. The sad part is, I can't go back there and find out what it sounds like because it always sounds differently for me than for you. Because I get the sound on the inside of the head, too. It's such a kind of an interesting echo effect. Where was I? Google, Yahoo, simplicity, text-based, no frills. Compare sites that you've seen, colleges, universities, so on. How many of them look like Google and Yahoo? Look at Blackboard or WebCT. Do they look like Google or Yahoo? Why not? Everybody loves Google and Yahoo. They work brilliantly. There isn't an LMS in the world that competes in terms of scale of users, popularity, or anything like that, yet they seem to diverge in terms of design. Consistency, simplicity. Well, as a learner, consistency? Yes. You can be, can't believe I'm saying this, you can be consistent as a learner. What does that mean? Well, I've put up a couple of notes here, but I mean, if you apply the principle a bit more across the board, you can still you can see that it can be applied in other areas. But the two that I came up with were clarify first principles. Now again, this slide presentation will be available on my website, so you can get that. But the slides were designed by professional designers, which is why we have light blue links on the light blue background. If it had been rank amateurs, right, it would have been like bright blue on white. It's amateurish like that, if you can read. Anyhow, that links to a paper I went to recently in my newsletter, Five Instructional Design Principles Worth Revisiting. Now, you may accept those principles, you may not accept those principles, but it's important to sit down at some point in time and think about and ask yourself, what do I think is true and what do I not think is true? And organize your information gathering accordingly. I think it's true, for example, that interactivity is important. And so, when I'm trying to learn about online learning, one of the things that I'm trying to learn about is interactivity. And so I'm always on, the interactivity is always on my radar screen. Or as I say, it sounds tautological, I say sometimes, like, if you know what you're looking for, it's easy to find. Okay, maybe it's not that tautological. So if you organize and think about what do I believe in this subject area, then finding the resources to help you learn about the subject area becomes that much simpler. When I do OWL daily, I go through piles and piles and piles of blanks. But I've sat down, I've said, this is important. This is interactivity important. Copyright important. Learning objects were important. And that sort of helps my radar pick out the things that are going to be important to me. Organize your knowledge. Here's a good question for you. How many of you have your own content management system? Your own personal content management system? Actually, that's about 10 more than I expected. That's good. You all should. Where are you putting your knowledge? I assume you have some. I know you have knowledge, but where is it? If you're like most people, it's probably buried somewhere in your email, waiting to be deleted the next time computing services does a purge. Don't tell me that doesn't happen. It's happened to me. It's so easy to have a content management system these days. And because of that, there's really no reason not to have one. I mentioned Drupal. If you Google Drupal, if I say that quickly, if you Google Drupal, D-U-R-P-A-L, what you will find is a site dedicated to an open source content management system that's written in a computing language called PHP. It will take your computer service people about 30 seconds to install it. Quite seriously, you need a web server of some sort to put it on. Oh, you don't have a web server? Web server accounts probably come with your internet service provider. If not, you can get a web server account from a service provider for about $10, $20 a month max. And you're okay to erase it. It seems to me that organizing your knowledge is worth at least that. But really, your college administration should be providing this for you. You should have a content management system so that any time you need to access your own knowledge, you can do it reliably, quickly, simply, and consistently. This is so much fun. Also, content coming in. You got content coming in. Most of the content that comes into you is not usable. You need to fix that content. When content comes in, as a learner, the first thing you should be doing is simplifying it and rewriting it in your own language. Remember I talked about taking notes during that talk. What you should be doing is, when somebody gives a talk, rewrite the talk in your own language. Because the person giving the talk almost certainly speaks a language different from you. I don't mean that they speak Russian. But they do. Well, I've already started putting terms around like RSS and Drupal and stuff like that, because that's the language I'm pretty comfortable with. And you know, the longer I'm up here, the more I'm going to slip into that kind of language. That's why they cut off my talks so that they can't. But you need to do a process of translation. When I talk about things, I connect them to my own experience, my own background. You need to connect these things to your own experience, your own background. That's why blogging is so useful, because blogging, remember, is personal, it's authentic, but it's also you taking the things that have come into your life, the knowledge, the information, and not just echoing it, because anyone can do that, all you need for that is tape recorder or something. But that comes in, you localize it, you internalize it, you make it part of a story about yourself, and then onto the blog, so you can find it later. And if it turns into a story about your cat, so be it. Your blog isn't written for the readers. Your blog is written for you. It is a knowledge translation summarizing device that just happens by accident to be useful to other people. This is way too much fun. I really should be forced to use the mouse so I don't have so much fun changing slides. Principles of usability. Really, there's only two. Usability is social. There need to be some conventions, some common understandings. And that's why I say learn from the masters like Google and Yahoo. And the other principle, usability is personal. What makes something usable is, in the end, nothing other than it is useful and usable to you. Because you're the learner. It's your content management system. It's your blog. It's your knowledge. It needs to be usable to you. And you, in the end, are the person who decides whether it's useful. You know, think about this talk again, right? Think about after this talk, we're all going to go away, we'll go off to our supper, and one of two things could be true. You'll be sitting there saying, either A, this talk was useful, or B, this talk was not useful. Now, who makes that call? So it's up to me, well, you know where I'm going. But the only person who can make the call for you about the usefulness and utility of this talk is you. And that is what is meant by usability. Guerrilla tactics. If you want usable information in your life, you will have to undertake guerrilla tactics. Your institutional CMS, if your institution has a CMS, is almost certainly dysfunctional. I say that based on experience with a wide range of CMSs. And the thing is, a lot of these CMSs, they're very good at what they do, but what they do is not to create a repository of information just for you. Mostly, they are created as tools for management to disseminate what it thinks is important to them. And so the CMS at your institution, forgetting the software for a moment, is organized and set up according to the organizational principles and standards of your organization. And if that matches your own internal knowledge landscape, that would be a miracle. So are the editors. Okay, they're not the vendors then. I can't really see you from here, so I've sort of internalized you in my mind as like Bender's Row, because you're all kind of lined up, but I don't know whether you are or you're not, but you're stuck with that fight in my mind. But it's always nice to connect at the back of the room once in a while. What do you do? Be a usability gorilla. Create a blog. Again, not because you want to publish, not because you want to become the next Insta pundit or something like that, but just as a place to take notes, because you think about it, you really don't have good places to take notes where they're easy to find later, right? If you use Blogger as a note-taking system, you can use Google to find your own notes. Think about it. You got pictures? Unless you have virtually unlimited bandwidth, or sorry, unlimited bandwidth in disk space, I work with the government, so I do, but unless you do, you're storing your images is a problem. Put them on Flickr. Flickr is spelled F-L-I-C-K-R. And if you add .com to it, that's the URL. They will accept your photographs. Roland Tanglao has uploaded somewhere around 10,000 photos to Flickr, and Flickr's going to keep them coming. Flickr allows you not only to upload your photos, it allows you to tag them, to share them, to link to them, where? In your blog. So, it's a great little place to store all your photos, and you can find them again. Here's a good one. Create a Gmail account and forward important emails to yourself. I've got an account, downs@gmail.com. I don't use it except for email storage. Why is this a good idea? Well, because if you are like most institutions, first of all, your email will break. How many of you have experienced your email system failing? This should be everybody. The rest of you who aren't raising your hands, I don't believe you. Gmail is almost always working. And even better, if you store your important emails in Gmail, say it with me, you can use Google to find them. And maybe, I haven't tested this, but I've heard good things, use a Google desktop search. You see the point here, right? Get away from the centralized, controlled, often unstable, and organized for somebody else's benefit institutional content management systems. Become an information gorilla, do it yourself, distribute it across the web, and make your information work for you. Right. Imagine, if you did that, how much better a learner you'd be. Because you can find the stuff that you learn. You don't have to remember it all. I depend on that. Relevance. Relevance is the hardest of the bunch. Nobody's really solved relevance yet, although we're getting close. The big change in the internet over the next few years is going to be massive amounts of suddenly relevant information. Once we get the identity thing worked out, the login thing worked out, the internet will be personally relevant to you. But we are where we are, so I'll talk about where we are. Relevance is very simple. Getting what you want, when you want it, and where you want it. Think about the information you get in your life, especially the information you're supposed to learn. How often has it been what you want, much less when you want it, and certainly not where you want it? Two major aspects to this. First of all, getting the right content. And those of you, which is all of you, who have struggled with spam, know what I mean. We get an awful lot of the wrong content, and very little of the right content. And to become a more effective learner, we need to flip this around. and got more of the right content and almost none of the useless content. And then the other thing, location, location, location. Having the right content is useless to you if it's in the wrong city. And that may sound trivial. Guess where all my books are right now? Home. Where's my book? I don't use bookmarks. I don't use bookmarks? No. I use my content management system. How do you think my newsletter started? It was bookmarks failing me because bookmarks were location specific. And it was like years before the invention of Perl. So I had to come up with some system that allowed me to have my bookmarks when I wanted them, where I wanted them. So what did I do? Well, this is before the invention of Blogger. So I wrote a little content management system, very simple, because I believe in simplicity. And it's just a little title and description, link, which turns out to be exactly the format of RSS. So now every time I see something that's interesting to me, I type in the title, short description, so I know what it was, because I'll forget, and the link, so I know where it is. And when you get it into the database, it goes. Do I categorize it? No. Categorizations change. Do I do anything with it other than that? No. So I was doing that for a few years, and then it occurred to me that this might be useful to other people. So as I created these bookmarks, I wrote another little program that took these things, put them in a little email message, and sent them out. That was roughly for my newsletter. My newsletter is my bookmark system. So my bookmarks, they're on my website. Anytime I have internet access, I have them. I've got more than 8,000 separate little items of resources that I've picked up over the years. Very easily findable. They're on my website. Guess what I use to find them?
Google.
There you go. Oops. Oh, wrong button. I don't know what that's going to do. You heard ticking something. Now, was that the right? Does this go backwards?
Yeah, there's the other button.
Yes. Okay, good. New technology. I really am a technical, really. I fear change. It doesn't change. All right. How do you get the information that you want? It's a two-step process. You would have thought there would be more. Oh, okay, I plagiarized that one. Step one, maximize your sources. Don't depend on one source. Don't depend on just a few sources. If you are depending on, say, my newsletter for information, as good as it is, get other sources too. You want to get sources from a wide range. And not just in the one topic area that's going to work. I get stuck in on digital photography. I get stuck in on online news, online government, because that's interesting to me. I get stuck in on China, because I'm interested in China. You know, a range of sources, a range of topics. Whatever you're interested in, don't let the job define you. Whatever you're interested in. You want that stuff coming in. I recommend go to Blog Ones. Oh wait, I have a pointer. Go to Blog. That really works, isn't it? Go to Blog Ones. I think I need one of those laser shoulders. How would this work? That's no improvement. I can't even see it from here. Blog Ones. BLOGLINES.com. Set up an account, do a little search, and Bloglines brings in information from, I don't know exactly how many, somewhere between 6 and 10 million different sources, give or take. So there'll probably be stuff that's interesting to you. If you can't find anything that's interesting to you, go to my website. On my website, look for a little orange button that says XML. Right-click on it and copy the link location. Or if you use Internet Explorer, copy shortcut, which I've never understood why they can't have. Different languages. Go back to blog lines, click add, right click, paste, submit. Now, what that will do is that will subscribe you to my RSS feed in blog lines. What does that mean? That means that every day that I publish my newsletter, it will show up in blind lines for you, all nicely formatted and everything. Now, what happens behind the scenes is I produce an XML version of my newsletter. Blog lines picks up the XML version of the newsletter. And it picks up a whole bunch more XML versions of newsletters. And the newspapers, CBC, BBC, CNN, New York Times, more educational bloggers than I can count. Now, the neat thing is, once you subscribe to one thing in blog lines, it will start making suggestions. Because it looks at the content. The thing with XML is it's machine readable. So the people at blog lines can write programs that are sort of semi-intelligently able to look at the feed that you subscribe to and recommend others. And that's what it will do. It will start recommending things to you. And that helps you find other feeds. Here's a really good tactic. Remember I told you to create a blog? If you create a blog on Blogger, your blog will have something like an RSS feed attached to it. If you take that and you subscribe to your own blog, I know it sounds very self-centered, but subscribe to your own blog in blog lines, not only will you get to read everything you've written, but blog lines, once again, will start suggesting things to you based on what? Based on what you wrote about. Isn't that good? And that's not even Google. Step two. Filter ruthlessly. I mean ruthlessly. If you don't need it, dump it. I have to read hundreds of emails every day, and that's after the spam has been eliminated. I am ruthless. I hit delete in a hurry. And you have to develop that mindset. If you are not definitely going to use this information later, get rid of it. Even if it's gone, it's probably out there on the web somewhere. And you know how to find it, right? And you got it. And if it's not on the web somewhere, or if human resources doesn't have it, or whatever, then it wasn't important. Seriously. Very important. Don't let someone else dictate to you what your information priorities are. The logicians in the room are saying, no, wait a second, how can that be right? But only you know what's important to you. Imagine I was organizing your information needs. How would that work for you? Probably not very well. You get a lot of stuff about cats. How's that going? Well, you know, spotting dog people at the end of this. They're the ones who sort of roll their eyes at all the cat rumors. Getting the information where and when you want it. Where and when you want it is almost never in a formal class or presentation. Trust me, I'm the speaker. I know that what you want now, alcohol, karaoke. Right? And yet I carry on. Sometimes I am a slave to the system. Do, now this may sound odd, do connect at home or on the weekends. And like you're thinking, I want to leave my work in the office. And I'm saying to you, if you organize your information, it's soon as I said that, I just rushed to the bathroom. Well, they're going to, okay, I don't want to know where they're going now. If you compartmentalize your work knowledge, your home knowledge, your vacation knowledge, you will almost certainly be getting the wrong information at the wrong time. Your brain, even your work brain, does not work from 9 to 5, does it? If you have any involvement in your work at all, and I'm not saying you all do, I'm betting most of you do, then you probably think about your work at times outside your work hours. Right? Then why are you cut off from your information gathering and storage system? Right? You want to help your brain do its thinking about work, even if it's a Sunday. Even if it's 3 in the morning sometimes. Moreover, a lot of your thinking you do about work, you probably do better away from work. I put down there, most work environments are dysfunctional. I wasn't even thinking of this myself, I said it. Work's a terrible place to do work. But I tell people in NRC, I'm going to take a couple of weeks of vacation, so I go home and get some work done. And I'm not kidding. I've written various papers over the years, and people are very pleased about those papers. The best papers I've written on vacation, because I'm not working. But what's really important is that you also embrace the flip side of that. And the flip side is at the bottom of the slide, so mostly you guys in the back can't read it at all. Oh, it's not on the, oh yeah, there it is. But feel free to sleep at the office. Some of you are managers. And as managers, you may have mixed feelings about this whole computer and internet thing, because you know that during work time, people are doing things like reading private email, playing solitaire, putting ads in eBay, all kinds of things that are not work-related. Well, that's the trade-off for people waking up at 2 in the morning, logging on, and making sure they don't lose that great idea that they got. And believe me, you want that trade-off. Because when you're cutting people off when they're not at work, you're losing their best ideas, or more accurately, what you're doing is you're trying to get them for free, right? If you're trying to get all of their time when they're at work, or whatever you can when they're not at work. But it's an exchange, it's a balance. Me, I do my best idle, aimless web surfing just after lunch. You come just after lunch and look for me doing work, forget it. It's not happening yet. I'm looking at Star Trek. Reading movie reviews. But 6:30 in the morning, I just got up, I'm ready to go, I'm reading email. I often have half my newsletter done by 7:30. Why? Because that's when the stuff came in, that's when I'm ready to think about it, that's when I go. So, you, as a learner, have to take charge of this. Don't let your employers tell you that you have to always be working at work. Getting a few titters. Think about it though. From the point of view of the person doing the work, doesn't that sound attractive? Isn't that the way you would rather be able to work? Then why don't you? Relevance, the right information at the right time. You need to think of people, you know, I shouldn't even have 8,000 bookmarks stored in my database, but I'll tell you, about 7,000 of them are currently useless. Not because the links don't work or things like that, but because it's information that's more than 6 months, more than 8 months old. These days especially, information is a flow. Information comes in, flows over us. Picture in this room, look at the information flowing in currents through the table. People think that information and knowledge is something you try to grab onto or hold and store. But that's not how it works at all. It's not how the brain works. You know this. You're an instructional designer. Right? It's not getting the information, somehow storing it. What you want as a learner is to put yourself in a position of repeated exposure to useful information. And this information changes shape over time, it's dynamic, it flows, and the idea is like if I wanted to be getting information from this group, I'd be kind of, now I'm wondering, I knew I was going to do this, kind of put myself in the right spot. Where's the flow going to come from? And getting the information and learning the information is just a matter of me putting myself in the right place. It's not a matter of me going to you or you and saying, tell me everything you know. Wouldn't work. But if I'm in a position to hear this conversation on a regular basis, and in the context of the work that I'm doing, if the same sort of information comes flowing over me on a regular basis, and it flows over me when I need it, when I can use it, that's when it becomes to be remembered. Memory is hardly ever an active, conscious process, but it's a process of experience. It's a process of repeated exposure to things. So as a learner, put yourself in a position to have good experiences. And if you don't believe me, I was 14 years old. We all wanted to be cool. And we went to the high school. And they were showing the film. They were showing Psycho. We got it. I still remember digitally clearly to this day. But what I learned that day is never go to horror films. Because the simple exposure to horror films puts those images in my mind. If I do it repeatedly, I have nightmares. Now, how did I get those nightmares? Because the information in those movies ended up in my head. And how did that happen? Because I put myself in a position to experience. So, I filter. I don't go to horror movies, ever. I have no nightmares. I think it's pretty smart, personally. I can't put like I had to watch Psycho to learn that, so I'm not sure how good a trade-off that was. Relevance is defined by function. This is a hard one. And it's hard to explain. I know I'm running out of time here. But a lot of people spend a lot of time categorizing information. And if you are going to approach information that way, then you need to be prepared to do it on a regular basis because categories change. Categories apply differently across different contexts. Rather, relevance depends on what you want to do. Information is relevant if it informs your current task. On the back end of my website, I organize my information, not by categories or things like that. I had a categories using system, but it's dynamic. I didn't turn it on and off. I don't do it anymore. I've never categorized my links. But, I organize my information by project. And then, I don't care what category it is. I don't care what kind of media it is. I don't care about any of that stuff. All I care about is it helps me do the project. And that's how I organize information. And if I need to find information of a certain type, well, I use Google. Information is relevant only if it is available where it is needed. Doesn't matter how good at collecting information you are, if you can't get at it when you need it, I'll take that as an editorial comment too.
Okay. We're almost there.
We're so close, I released it. Because I want to do it too. I've been working for the last hour. Okay. Relevance, guerrilla tactics. Yes, you too can be a relevance guerrilla. Develop unofficial channels of information, and I mean this very seriously, disregard most of the official ones. And if you don't believe me, look in your email, and you've probably saved these, so you can do this. Look at the email that has come from your director or your supervisor, and ask yourself, of these emails, how many of them did I need when I got it? For all of those emails that you did not need when you got it, delete it. Why? Because you don't need it. I scan, okay, I just scan them so I can make the assessment, right? But then the stuff that comes in, I get stuff. I work for a large organization, really large organization. I get stuff coming in all the time from directors, from supervisors, from human resources, whatever. I look at it, and I think I have maybe two items left in my inbox from any of these people I draw them to. Your experience may vary. But what I'm trying to emphasize here is don't think that something is important just based on where it came from. You have to weigh the relevance of each thing and ask yourself, will this change my life? Will I ever use this information in the future? I get these security bulletins all the time. It's like in and out, fast as you can go. But because I already know about security. I don't need computer services messages about security. Everything from the director. The director is so far removed from me, because I'm at the bottom of the organization, director's up here. Virtually nothing the director says changes how I do my job. Now sometimes, you know, I appreciate it, he sends out a message to inform me of something, you know, like we have no funding or something like that. Help, scan it, delete it. You don't need to scan it. The unofficial channels of information will be the useful ones. The networks of friends that you develop, the email contacts, the blogs that you read. These are the important things because these are people typically doing the same job, often in the same way, often working with the same body of information. It is almost dead certain that their information will be much more relevant to you because it relates directly to your experience. Great project pages. Remember I said I organize my content, my project. How do I get to that? Well, I put a wiki on my website. Remember I said use Drupal, 10-minute install for computer services? Wikis are easier to install. So, while you're getting them to install Drupal for you, you can get them to install some wiki software. Or if you don't want to mess around with software, go to a place like JotSpot, or even create your own little private area of Wikipedia or something like that. I don't know how they react to that. I don't know if that's been tried, but I can try it. You need to do it. I bet you they wouldn't mind. I bet you if you created a section on Wikipedia dedicated to information and links relevant to your own work, what would you really need is not only would you have that information organized the way you want it to, every time you went back to it, it would be a little bit better than it was. If you don't know what Wikipedia is, Google it. Demand access. You need, and these days almost have the right to be in contact with your information. And I'll say the one negative thing that I would ever say to the organizers of this conference, where's the wireless? Right? If you go to a conference, and say, but I blame myself, not the organizers, because I did not make that expectation clear ahead of time. Right? I did not tell the organizers, you know, when I knew at this conference, in order for me to function effectively as a leader, I'm going to need wireless access. So, you know, I'm in there in this room this morning, and you know, I'm trying to Google something he said to see if it's true. No Google. I have to take his word for things. The order from Microsoft is on that. I'm just kidding. Demand access. I went to a hotel. There's no internet in the room. I made sure that the hotel knows that I need internet. Right? They gave me water. It wasn't an option as to whether or not I got water in my room. Electricity. I have electricity. That wasn't optional. Contact with my information base is now a necessity of life. Okay. Almost there. But we're so close we can taste it. Interactivity, usability, relevance. Now, I am hoping, if I have given you a successful talk, I am hoping at this point that you at least partially agree with me, if not wholeheartedly agree with me, that if you adopted something like the tactics and the methodology I've suggested so far tonight, modified for your own needs, of course. Right? I'm just giving it one way, one picture, one way of looking at it. That this would make you a better learner. You're saying you're not doing these things. You're arguing these things, but you're sitting there thinking, yeah, I'm a pretty good learner. Right? Okay, I'm hoping you agree with that. I am seeing certain odds, so I'll take that as validation. I'm sometimes very insecure. What I'm really saying now, point number one, you, each of you individually, are at the center, you are the center of your own personal learning network. You're connected to people, you're connected to content, information sources. That's the first point. You're at the center of your own personal learning network. Secondly, to take advantage of this, you need to be self-directed. You are the one who decides what's relevant. You are the one who decides what's usable. You are the one who picks the channels of interactivity. You pull the content. But to be self-directed, you must be self-directed. So this is the lesson I learned so many years ago at the Gauntlet. In order to be a newspaper, to be autonomous, to be effective, that was not going to come to us from anywhere else. Nobody was going to give it to us. It's like freedom. Nobody can give you freedom. It's like empowerment. Nobody can give you empowerment. You have to be autonomous. You have to be self-directed. You have to be free. That's what I'm saying. You know, like sleep in the office. Disregard your director's email. Now, don't do what I said just as I said it, but make these calls yourself. Direct your own work. And then finally, and this is the kicker, these principles should govern not just how you learn, but how you teach. And that's my talk. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for having actually focused on learning, as teaching is to advance the learning, and I think that starting with the end in mind, you know, is very appropriate. Except I'll never look at back and favor the same way. I'm thinking archiving, analog, but I hope you like it. Because what's inside is a little bit more smooth than paper. So thank you so much, and will, I guess, be moving to the very interactive part of the evening. And I show there's talent in the room, or no talent, that'll be more fun, as funny or funnier. And maybe we can give American and Canadian Idols some competition, right? So thank you so much, and please have a wonderful rest of the evening.